This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Ready. It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
It's time for episode 134 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. I'm so glad you're listening because you get to hear a great interview with Peter J. Tomasi, one of my favorite writers in comics today. We talk particularly about The Light Brigade, which is the first story of his I ever read, which is a great war story and contains some things that I didn't expect, so it was a great read. It's recently been put out in a hardcover edition, and we talk about that as well as his other work on Batman and Robin and The Mighty. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show.
I want to welcome to the podcast Peter Tomasi, one of my favorite writers of many good things, including The Mighty, which I really enjoyed, and Batman and Robin, which is going on currently, and what we really want to talk about, The Light Brigade. How are you doing today, Peter?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Wayne?
Good. It's good to talk with you. Let's dive right into The Light Brigade, because that is a book, the first one I ever read of yours, which really just floored me, I have to say. It was a great book. It combines a lot of stuff, let's say, that... You combine history with events of biblical proportion, shall we say.
Yeah, that's for
and
sure.
It's really good stuff, and things happen in there that I was very surprised to read. And it's one of those books that, honestly, I felt like it was a real story when I got to the end. Because, you know, I wondered, was that really history? Is he really telling us what really happened in there? It was such a well-told story.
Thank
how
you.
How did the book come to be?
It really started from a... I've been a big history nut for most of my life, and a big World War One nut. And one day I was just sort of looking through an old book about World War One cemeteries, and suddenly, you know, you see that some of them had taken, you know, were sort of around World War Two battles. And I'm thinking, like, you know, wow, how cool would it be if an American soldier is literally in an American World War One cemetery during World War Two and actually has to dig a foxhole right there next to a grave of, you know, a fallen comrade back from World War One. So it sort of just always stuck with me, and it was one of those ideas you jot down, and it ends up, paying off at some later point.
Do you carry a little notebook around with you in case you get ideas?
I do.
That's good, because this time it really worked for you. Now, The Light Brigade, do you want to tell people what the TV Guide version of what it is?
Yeah, sure. It's really, it's a battleground that's taking place in, in Belgium in 1944 during the Battle of the Bulge. And it's really sort of, one of those, I guess I'm trying to think of the quickest, you know, easiest. I always have trouble summing my stuff up in like a quick little 2-minute pitch, but it's really kind of like, you know, still reeling from the horrors of, you know, of World War II, our character, you know, the main guy, Chris Stavros, who's an American soldier, you know, he's got one goal. And, you know, the goal for him, it's sort of like a little twist on Saving Private Ryan, where, you know, actually instead of, you know, the home getting a letter and saying, hey, your son's in jeopardy and they've lost somebody, here's a soldier who's in the trenches who actually gets a letter saying, you know, hey, your wife has been killed in a car accident, and because there are no other relatives, your son is going to be put into foster care. So he's like, you know, talk about motivation for wanting to, one, to live, and two, wanting to get your ass back home. So, you know, he basically has that one goal, getting home safely, you know, to care for his son after learning his wife died. And, you know, he's basically suddenly is faced with some, you know, heavenly warriors that are, you know, sort of come down from the sky, and he's given a mission to recover the lost sword of God. So he's got to, you know, fight these unkillable, what appear to be German soldiers, and who then, of course, turn out to be something else entirely.
That was the great thing about the book. Well, and one of the reasons you may have a little trouble summarizing all this stuff is because it's like over 200 pages long.
Yep. Yeah, it is. It's tough to break down into like a quick little thing, and so it's tough to get that across. But I think, you know, if somebody who loves, you know, big high octane action at the same time mixed with history and of course archangels and different religious elements that are taken seriously yet still sort of woven into the tapestry of the story with sort of a specific bent towards serving the story and not just sort of exploiting it, I think people will really enjoy the book. I mean, the quick pitch is too. It's like, you know, it's Saving Private Ryan meets, you know, The Evil Dead. Saving Private Ryan meets, you know, Paradise Lost meets, you know, Where Eagles Dare. You know, all these great World War II genre pieces mixed with, you know, all this biblical epic, you know, stuff.
Well, the thing that's great about the book is 200 pages of story, and it goes like a shot to me.
It really does, right?
I didn't even realize how many pages it was until I went back and looked and said, oh my goodness, that's 200 pages. Because it's one of those great stories that just pulls you in and you get pulled along with it, and you get to you care about the characters. You're fascinated by what's really going on. And you're actually, at least I was scared by what was happening. You know, all this stuff. You have these kinds of things. Not that the Nazis weren't bad enough, but now we've got these other things going on, making things even worse.
Right.
So to me, that was just what made the story, you know, hard to put down. I literally had to read all 200 pages at the same time.
Thanks.
First time I read it. So well done. And this is why I'm kind of hoping that people will do. And another thing, too, I wanted to mention, too, is that you have a lot of interesting surprises along the way. And none of which I want to spoil, believe me, because I want people to be able to read this thing, because it has so many interesting little twists and turns that I never expected. And it's just one of those great things that it literally felt like reality to me when it was over with. I literally sat there and said, now, did that really happen or was that a story?
Right. You know, I think, you know, you get plugged into that because you care about the characters. And I think, like you said, you were scared. You're not just scared for what's the outside elements that are encroaching. You're scared because I was, even as I was writing, and you're invested in these guys. And I took great pains to make sure that, you know, in those kinds of stories, you could always easily fall into that trap of just making, you know, real cliche one-note characters. And I wanted, you know, to really make sure that each of the soldiers in the platoon had a distinct voice, had a distinct sort of outlook in life. And, you know, I think it's not spoiling anything, as several of them get picked off and face a horrible end, you know, you're right there with them and you really care about the loss. You know, you get really, you know, you get sucked in. I remember writing a certain scene and just thinking like, oh man, I really love that character. I hated to see him go. And, you know, it's really great as a reader when you get pulled in like that. I mean, I know when I'm reading books, you know, and I'm a character guy first. I don't care about action because it's just action. But if I care about the people going through it, that action is heightened.
Well, you get that sense a lot in your writing and in this book particularly. And it makes me want to ask you, where did the characters come from? Did you base people on individuals you knew, or these did you create them in your head? How did these people come to be?
A couple of them were sort of. I mean, the main character is basically me. And, you know, I sort of looked at it because in a weird way I was exploring my own, you know, upbringing, being an old altar boy and, you know, going to church on Sunday school and stuff. And so you start to use what you know. So So that's how I sort of approached it. And, you know, all the other characters, there's every little character always usually has something of yourself in it, little bits. But there was a couple of friends of mine, you know, over the years who, you know, had distinct personalities that definitely fit some of these guys, too. So it was fun to see, fun to transpose some of their personalities on some of these characters.
Now, it's fun, too, because each one is distinctly different from the others. And, you know, when you get this many guys around, especially if you're in a war setting, oftentimes things kind of water down for everyone's just trying to survive. And when that happens, you don't get to see the nuances between person to person. But I thought you did a really good job on that, of making sure that we understood and cared about the characters as they were very different from each other. I like that a lot.
Yeah, it was, you know, the best characters are the ones that sort of are in conflict with each other, even in small ways, be it the comic book fan in the group, you know, with somebody else who doesn't respect the kid who likes comics. And, you know, there's just the gruff, of course, the, you know, our other lead character, the Sergeant Marcus, and how he plays into things. So it's, you know, it's got these real nice shadings that kind of really bring the characters to life and just makes you really invested in everything they go through. And even the even the bad guy, you know. I mean, I took great pains to really, in a way, identify with the bad guy to make sure that, you know, he just wasn't an evil twirling mustache kind of guy who, you know, just felt, you know, two-dimensional. I wanted him to, in a weird way, I wanted you to kind of feel for him, you know, and kind of, you know, I can see what he's thinking, why he's in a weird way doing this. You know, that old adage that a lot of writers, you know, of course, uses, you know, the best villains are the ones who think they're heroes of the story, and he's, you know, a prime example of that.
Well, it's kind of interesting to me because he ends up being sort of, well, I don't want to give away too much, but let's just say he becomes something of an angelic character.
Right.
And of course, to have a Nazi who was something of an angelic character, That was against type. It felt
right
to me. You know?
Yeah, to say the least. I just, you know, I wanted to strip away that. I mean, you know, in a weird way, the Nazi garb, the Nazi guise is just that. It's a mask that they're wearing, and you know, that gets pulled away, and then you reveal their true selves. And of course, in you know, they're still bad guys. They're still, you know, they're doing things that are against what's good. So those, you know, the bad guys in that story are still, you know, not that they're Nazis per se, but they're still the type of characters you feel good when they get blasted. You know, you're like, yay, good riddance.
Because, you know, this book to me, and it's really the case in many of the books that I really enjoy, I could see this as being a movie.
Yeah, really. We've gone the route a few times up and down, and as you probably heard talking to other writers and other creator-owned projects, it's a labyrinth of, you know, insanity to finally get some of this in front of a camera. And you know, the funny part is like, even someone like me, even someone like you, you can direct this film. All you got to do, their storyboards are right there. You know, Peter Snaberg and Bjarne Hansen, who colored this, was just amazing. I mean, I would just give that to a director of photography and say, all right, I'm directing this. Make sure we cast it right, and here's the shots. These are it. You know, I mean, the editing, it's all there. I mean, he's awesome. And, you know, Peter worked from a screenplay for this book. I had not broken it into a comic book script. My writing is in a specific way when I write a screenplay. So when I gave it to him, I said, you know, I'm going to break this down for you. He's like, no, I love it like this. This is perfect. I can see exactly what you want. It was amazing to watch him deconstruct the screenplay into a comic, because he kept every line of dialogue from the screen. There's not one dialogue line missing. And he just broke it down beautifully. And he's an amazing guy, artist-wise. And, you know, and the colorist, of course, added, you know, just a brilliant palette to that, where it's just, it really shines. And this new printing by Dark Horse really did an awesome job to showcase Peter's art and Bjarne's colors.
You know, it's interesting because the gritty parts, the down to earth parts, are just as realistic to me as the quote unquote, you know, angelic heavenly parts
right
are to me. They work. You know, the whole thing works so well to me that this is why when I got to the end and thought it was real, because the marriage of the story and the art to me was just ideal. And I just you know, both of the, how you guys did that is just, I wish other people could figure out, but sometimes, but it's just such a great thing. And the way that it's done, I'm really glad that Dark Horse is giving it a hardcover. Now, what was your reaction? How did that come to be? Because originally this, the version that I originally read was a trade.
Right. It was, well, it first came out as a 4-issue prestige back in the day. Remember DC and Marvel used to do those, you know, $5.95 prestige books, 48 pagers, hard stock covers, beautiful paper. So they did that for Light Brigade for 4 issues. Mm. And then, they collected it, of course. And, you know, it did really solidly, but, rights reverted back to me after a few years, and you know, they were cool with it and said, hey, you know, go with God. And I took it and talked to Dark Horse right off the bat, and they, you know, really just without hesitation, Daniel Chabon over there was great, and Scott Alley, and they made it happen lickety split, and they did a great job on the cover and all the supplementary stuff and the printing. It's a great book, and it gives it another life to a brand new audience. You know, it's really cool. I mean, and at conventions, I get, you know, I always get people coming up talking about the book, which is always nice for a book that's, you know, several years old now, but gets a chance to fall into the hands of a new generation.
Mm-hmm. I like the extra parts in it because I always like behind the scenes thing, knowing how things came to be, and you've got some stuff. We get to see portions of your actual script.
Right. Yep. And then you can see how Pete would break some of that down. Pete Snaberg would break some of that down. So it's pretty cool. It's just amazing how he could keep everything that I wrote and still. I mean, because when you look at the book too, he's a consummate storyteller. And, you know, scan through that book. There's not, I believe, and I'm actually going to look through it right now. I think there is only one real true splash page in the entire book. Everything else is panels and beautiful sequential storytelling. The only page in the book, which is actually a splash page without any other panel but one big super panel, is like when they first arrive at the monastery. And that's it. There's no other splash in that entire book. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. It's really well done. Now, another thing too, what fascinates me is you juggling what may literally be a cast of thousands. You know, you talk about the monks and the Nazis and the sort of Nazis and then the Americans. You've got all these different groups going along, and it was so easy to keep track of them the way that you told the story and the way that the art went. Was that, you know, because sometimes in war stories, you know, everybody's wearing fatigues and it's kind of easy to you know, lose people, but I never lost track of who was who.
Yeah, that took a lot of great pains in the story, and also Peter to make sure, Snaberg, to make sure that with two Peters, it's always tough to differentiate. But Snaberg took great pains to give them all, you know, when you see Simon, the comic book guy, you see him and you know who he is. You know, you see Marcus, you see Christopher, you see Jesse with the cowboy guy. I mean, it's, you know, his entire face is shaped. It's distinct. It pops. And yeah, I mean, I would love this. This does belong. This should be a movie. It's perfect. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a perfect movie. And no one's, you know, I feel like some films have pulled from this here and there throughout the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So I'm just hoping that one day we get a chance to do it as a film, because I think a lot of people would dig it. I think it has a great international appeal, and I think it would be a really solid flick.
Do you think this is something that kids could, or children, or young adults could enjoy?
You know, I really do. I mean, I think anywhere from 10 and up, based on, of course, every kid is different, but I feel most of them, and I'm basing this on my own 11-year-old and the friends he plays with and the games that they play, and I've just recently let him play PlayStation and Xbox, so I think it's key for kids to, they're eviscerating and blasting people away, non-entities, you know, human beings on a video screen, on a big TV, 50-inch screen all day. I think it's important for them to see somebody bleed and die, and maybe if they've emotionally invested in during the course of the story and feel something for them, I think that's a positive thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's a good thing, so it just doesn't become a, you know, I think it boils down to the old, you know, when the erosion of empathy, you know, I mean, if they can't feel something as they're doing all this violence, that's scary, you know. I want them to be a bit, oh my God, you know, that's troublesome. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll recover. There's Grimm's fairy tale that's been around, you know, horror and violence and terror has been around forever in kids' literature.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a story like this that takes itself seriously and doesn't, you know, make you just throw all these characters out there just to be killed as cannon fodder, I think it's not a bad thing for them to see it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I agree with you. I think that there are good things to be learned from this story, and things are gone. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there are some biblical implications going on. And I was just sort of curious, over the years, did you get much in the way of reaction from that? Because some of the things you do are a little extra biblical, shall we say. And I was just kind of wondering, did you get much in the way of negative reaction to the
You know
that
what? Book? I haven't. I expected to.
Mm-hmm.
But at every turn, even from when it was first published at DC,
mm-hmm.
people were, they really saw that I was having an argument with myself or with the, mm-hmm. you know, the character was having an argument about faith and God and all that stuff. And it wasn't done in a jokey, comical way. It was done in a mm-hmm. very, you know, serious way. So I think people, you know, even people who saw all this wild stuff happening, I think they still appreciated the fact that I was taking religious, you know, a religious aspect of the story seriously and not making fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that makes a big difference to people.
Because there's one thing, and I can't spoil it for love nor money, but I would love to. There's something that happens. There's a certain person that's involved in this. A certain something happens to this person, and it revives something. More than that, I don't want to say. But when I read that, I was just like, wow. You know, that was you could almost see that kind of thing happening,
right.
Even though it's not specifically mentioned in the Bible anyplace. Those were the kind of things that made the story kind of breathe for me in along those ways, was making not only living people but things that were very likely to have happened
mm-hmm.
take place. I was very worried that you might get some reaction from people. That's not in the Bible. How can you do that? How can you do that?
I thought I would run into some hiccups too in that regards, but it actually never came to pass. People people were like, you know, wow, what you did. You know, exploring the, you know, Christian elements and Judeo. I mean, it all kind of just, people just didn't seem to be upset by it. They sort of rolled with it and saw that it wasn't, like I said, I wasn't poking fun at it or mm-hmm. cracking wise about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was great. Those kinds of things made the story stand out to me so much. And it's just such a great book. And that way, there's one sentence in the book that I wanted to ask you about. That coming in towards the end, and Marcus is telling Christopher something.
Mm-hmm.
He says, every day is judgment day.
Right.
And that sentence to me really summed up the whole story. I thought that was just such a great bit of dialogue there. It's very difficult sometimes. You talked a little about having trouble sometimes to boil down these things. But that one sentence to me exemplified exactly what the story's talking about.
Thanks. Yeah,
and
the fact that you pulled that out is pretty awesome because – I can't even begin to tell you how long I spent at the table reworking and trying to come up with that line. And it did. It summed up everything that people just – and because to me what that line meant even in the end was, you know, either you're religious or you're not. You have faith or you don't. But in the end, you know, every day is judgment day for your own soul and for, you know, for the own goodness inside yourself. So you either do the right thing or you do the wrong thing. If you believe in a God, it's, you know, be it, whether you believe in a God or whether you don't, it still means something.
Mm-hmm.
Do the right thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good message to have in a comic today, which is not what we get oftentimes in comics. But what's interesting to me is that this hardcover now has been out a little while. But it's kind of hard to find sometimes, and that's because I know people who have ordered it in stores, and
right.
It's basically gone through. People have sold through it. So I know some stores are trying to get more copies of it. I know it's available on Amazon.
Yeah.
If people can't find it in your local comic shop, I would recommend you go to Amazon. Are there other places that you can – is this available digitally?
I think actually Dark Horse has made it available digitally too, so people should definitely check out darkhorsecomics.com, I believe, and see that scenario. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's always been, you know, people who found it enjoyed it, and I think it disappeared from the shelves, and in some weird way, people, I think, just they never ordered enough, and I think that, and I really do think the audience is out there for this kind of stuff, and they just seem to keep dropping the ball on making sure it's got some visibility.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that with the Dark Horse edition, at least some people will, you know, I hope they find it, because it'd be a shame not to get it into more people's hands on a second go around.
Well, that's how I got a hold of it, was that, you know, every once in a while you end up in a store and you've got a little extra money and something didn't come in that you expected. And I would always ask people, what should I be reading? And this was one of those things that was recommended to me. And when I got, like I said, when I got it home, I was like so grateful that somebody's told me how great this story was. You know, I actually got to sit down and dive into it myself. So I'm encouraging people out there, if you can't find the hardcover, find the digital version, go to Amazon, do whatever you can, because this story deserves to be read. And it really needs to be something that, if you don't have it in your library, you really need to put it in there to flesh out your library with some great variety and some great storytelling.
Thanks. I appreciate that. That's because it means a lot. And, you know, I remember when it first came out, I mean, Publishers Weekly literally said this is the best comic of 2000, and I think it was 2004. I mean, it was
wow. It
was really, you know, and not to tout my own horn, but I just you know, you want, when you do something that you're really proud of, you just want people to find it, at least read it. I don't care if you hate it or love it, but just I love people just to get it and get a reaction out of people.
Well, so many people have told me how great it is, and now I'm one of them as well. I'm in the chorus now, so kind of fun stuff to do that. So, again, highly recommend The Light Brigade. But I wouldn't be a good Bat fan if I let you go without asking you a couple of things about Batman and Robin, if I can. Now, of course, no spoilers, because I want to know what's going on. I want to be able to read them as they happen. But, you know, what was your reaction when you found out that Grant Morrison was actually going to follow through and put Damian Wayne under the way that he did?
You know, the funny thing is, I was on staff at DC as the Batman group editor. Mm-hmm. Actually, hired Grant to write Batman. So he was doing All-Star Superman. And then I got on the phone with him one day, and I spent like an hour convincing him why he should do both of the main company's characters at the same time and how cool that would be. Mm-hmm. And he eventually agreed and went down to Dan DeBeal's office and said, "Hey, I got Grant Morrison to do Batman." So I knew about Damian. He wanted to kill Damian earlier on,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't do it. And then after I had left, of course, I was still in the Bat group as a writer, so I knew all the plans at that point.
Mm-hmm.
A few times it changed, but no, it was no surprise that he was going to kill Damian. I mean, I would be lying if I said I had hoped maybe he'd change his mind and not kill him, but he did kill him. And I think in a weird way, I think it served our story and our journey of a father and son really well. I thought,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I look back on these hardcovers and trades now, that, you know, Pat Gleason and I did, it just, again, I'm very lucky to work with an artist who, you know, I'm so simpatico with, and he just kicked serious ass and just did an amazing job on this series, as he continues to do. I mean, we're on issue 34, I believe. Out of 34 issues, he's missed an issue and a half.
Wow.
And I think that's pretty much maybe him and one other person, I think, from the start of the New 52. Maybe it's only Greg Capullo. I don't think there's anybody else that comes close to that. And
wow.
Especially in terms of consistency, you know,
mm-hmm.
of quality. So it's a book that I'm really proud of. And it's like, you know, bringing up the Damian bit, it really helped. I think it made the story just that much more poignant and just more heartfelt, that we could explore that death and that life and death in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people really, you know, because I could get the focus on Damian more
mm-hmm.
than Grant could do, I was able to really just, you know, keep adding more meat to the skeleton, so to speak, so that when he did die, I think people felt it, you know, even more.
Mm-hmm. Were you surprised that people actually liked Damian?
Well, I know, you know, from all the cons I've gone to over the years, people definitely, the one thing I always, the first time, every time somebody walks up is, "You know what? You made me love Damian." Everybody says they started out hating him, and
uh-huh.
you know, as I shaded him up some more and just had more fun with him and did some more stories with him, it people sort of, you know, some people love to hate, you know, a character, and some people, you know, really just got on board with him and really enjoyed, you know, what Pat and I were doing with him. So it was nice to see that at conventions, that people who had written off the character and really didn't want to see him were now really sad to see him go and just hoping that we would bring him back one day.
Well, now you've got an event coming up, and correct me if I forget the title wrong. It's The Hunt for Robin?
The Hunt for Robin is actually just winding down in issue 32 of Batman and Robin. Mm-hmm. And then after that starts Robin Rises, number one, mm-hmm. which is Andy Kubert, and that ships in July, followed by Batman and Robin 33 through 37, which takes us into December. It's one big Uber storyline, and then Robin Rises, number two, comes out in December. And at that moment in time, readers will once again see a dynamic duo back together again.
Okay. More than that, we don't want to say because they don't like spoilers.
Exactly.
But I've always said to people, you know, this is Ra's al Ghul's, relative, and there's this little thing, you know, that he goes into and he gets revived, and why they didn't do that with Damien, some of us can't understand. But
right. Yeah, that was an easy out. You know, that was the first thing you're going to put him in a last pit. And I'm like, no, I'm not. So it's, you know, when December rolls around, it's going to be, there will be a Robin again, and it'll be interesting to see how the fans react.
Okay. Well, you guys have had a good good track record with us, and we're dying to see what you have in store for us there.
Thank you.
Because I know that you're a big Batman fan, according to Wikipedia, which is never wrong, of course, said that you got into into Batman when you were young, and honestly, I got into Batman as a when I was young as well, and so
it's an easy character to sort of glom onto when you're a kid, and obviously mm-hmm. the Halloween costumes at that age, and you know, reruns of the Batman show, and then of course, you know, the Batman movies and the comics too of that period were the Denny O'Neil and the Neil Adams and, you know, my favorite Batman artist, Jim Aparo. It was a great time to be, you know, a Batman fan, and he was being done right and really some cool stuff, and it was an easy character to really fall in love with. I mean, he is without doubt, you know, my favorite character in the DCU. So it's been great to get a chance to write him, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're looking forward to seeing what you've got coming up as far as Robin goes. So I'm going to be there with bated breath, so I can't wait to see that.
I'm glad to hear it.
But I've got one other series that you did that I really liked, and nobody seems to talk about it, and I'd like to see it come back, was The Mighty.
Oh, The Mighty, yes. That was another creator-owned book from DC that they were great to let me do. And you know, we had a nice 12-issue run. It had a beginning, middle, and an end. And the people who read it and could find it loved it. So it was another one of those books that I think, you know, disappeared without getting. It was one of those books that just kind of disappeared as much without getting enough of the people who read it, the critics that read it, you know, all really enjoyed it. And it just it disappeared. And I think what didn't help, was that when DC collected it, they broke it into two volumes instead of one issue volume. And so it was months between trades, and people just didn't find it and never got a chance to get into it. And the good thing is, once again, Dark Horse has, you know, stepped into the fray, and the rights have reverted back to me and Keith Champagne. We co-wrote it, and Peter Snaberg was the artist on it, and Chris Samney came in as of issue 5 and did amazing. And Chris Stanley came and did amazing work on it with Don Kalis as the colorist, and it was awesome. So they're Dark Horse is putting it out, I believe. This isn't gospel, but I think it's December, and of course it'll be all in one volume. And supplementary section, new, really beautiful cover by Ryan Sook, and of course all the interior, you know, cover, all the original covers will be preserved too inside by the great Dave Johnson, but new cover by Ryan, and it'll be nice. It's as Light Brigade, I'm hoping it's getting, you know, it gets a second life into a new, you know, a bunch of new readers' hands to find and enjoy.
See, I didn't know anything about that. I just happened to love the series, and I wanted to mention it. So, man, my whole day is made. I'm going to get to have that. Now, is it going to be hardcover or trade?
It'll be trade, actually.
Okay, so this will be trade. Well, that'd be good to start that way, because then if that picks up, then you can always come back and do some other ones. But, man, I am really thrilled to hear that. If this does well, do you have any other ideas for The Mighty? Might this be the beginning of a Mighty return?
It could. Through Dark Horse, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we're doing with it to garner interest initially is Keith Champagne is writing three issues in Dark Horse Presents of The Mighty, sort of a prologue back in because the character obviously was around for a while, so you see him in a different time period. Mm-hmm. Really nice stuff by Leonard Kirk drawing it, and John Kalis once again coloring it. So it's it'll be nice to see it to see that prologue and the reaction to that as we lead into the resolicitation of the collected edition of all the issues in one place, so people can finally get that story and then not try searching for a second volume that is probably way out of print or very, very hard to find now.
Well, man, I'm really excited to hear that. I can't wait to get that, and it's just in time for the holidays too, so that's going to be perfect.
Yeah, it is. I'm hoping people really enjoy it, and you know, it's nice to get things out there again. It's mm-hmm. You know, it's really important when you care about a project.
Hey, Peter, are there any other projects you're working on that we should be aware of?
Right now, I'm working on another thing with Dark Horse called House of Penance with an artist called Ian Bertram. He just did a Detective Comics 27, 12, mm-hmm. 10-pager in the anniversary issue that came out in January. And he's also doing a 12-page Secret Origins Damian Wayne story that I just actually dialogued up today, which looks awesome. Mm. A really great artist. I think people will be really surprised by this guy. He's got a hell of a lot of talent, and he hasn't done a lot of things, so I'm really happy to have found him and working on some projects with him.
Great. Anything else, or has that got you pretty busy?
That does have me pretty busy. There's one project going to be announced shortly with DC, which I can't say anything about right now, but it's another really cool project that I'll be taking over. So, with another great artist. So,
great.
Yeah, it'll be really awesome. So I think people will be really digging what we got to bring to the table on this book.
Oh, great. Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Of course, we'll keep our ears to the ground and find out what that news is when it's announced.
Thank
you. So, I really like that. There's so much good stuff in them. When I see your name, I'm after that book like crazy. So.
Oh, good. I'm happy that, you know, at least people will see it. And, you know, my name means, you know, at least they'll get a quality story with characters they care about. That's, you know, as a writer, that's all you can ask for.
Really. That is just good stuff. That's the essence of comics right there in that one sentence. So,
thank you.
Great stuff. So, well, Peter, you know, much success. Hopefully all these things will take off and we'll get to see much more of it as we go forward.
Yep, absolutely, Wayne. I appreciate talking with you today, and look forward to seeing you at the con.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne, as a man. From flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but it's a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Now at MajorSpoilers.com. And that's a wrap for this episode. Be sure to be back next week when I'll have another interview with a great comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
You'll never win, Joker. I'll always be here to stop you.